This Bible study was recorded at St. Andrew's Baptist Church on Thursday, the 25th of January 2018. Danny Sitton is bringing part 14 in his series on the book of Genesis.
Holy Father, as we come to your word, we come with full respect that this is your word to us. This is you speaking to us. And Holy Father, I pray that you would speak to each of us this evening as we deal with events that happened many thousands of years ago. But I pray, Heavenly Father, you give us a fresh insight so that we may be able to walk more closely to you as a result of what we look at this evening. I pray this is not my ideas, it's not my work, this is just you speaking to us. So Holy Father, let us all learn together in Jesus' precious name. Amen. Each week, the recap gets a little bit longer, and what we've got to look forward to gets a little bit shorter. We're getting well over halfway now through Genesis. So for those that haven't been, certainly recently, just a quick recap, and I'll try and make it quick. We've got created universe right at the beginning of Genesis. If it's not, well, it's perfect, even though mankind has been given a job to do. But the big thing that distinguishes mankind from the other creation is they've got free will. And this is the act of a loving God. Without free will, we are just robotic beings created to artificially worship some deity. We've been given free will, which means we can walk away. We have an escape route, and that is what makes us unique. And that was an act of love from God. And we did walk away. And due to that rebellion against God, there are two major fractures in this created world. The first one occurs at the fall, and now the world is not as it was created to be. And the next one occurs at the flood of Noah. Mankind descends in between, morality declines in between these two fractures to a point where God says he's going to basically start again. So Noah and his family are taken out of that incredible judgment, and the world they descend on in the ark is pretty much the world we've got today. That's kind of my reading of those early chapters in Genesis. I believe in a literal creation account that occurred over six literal days, but what we see now in the world around us is most similar to what it was like when Noah stepped off the ark. And then we had Babel, where we have this dispersion of languages, and man is basically, circumstances lead to mankind spreading across the face of the earth. And up to now, God has dealt with the world in a worldwide dealings. It's all worldwide. And it's at this point now that in God's plan for this promised Redeemer, he's now going to narrow his focus to an individual nation. And it starts with Abraham. And we went through four Bible studies looking at the life of Abraham. And then the focus changed to Isaac. And we've got land promises, we've got promises to be a nation, we've got various covenants that are made along the way, and we looked at these different covenants. So we've got Abraham, we've got Isaac, and the big thing with Isaac, and he is a major type of Jesus Christ. And the most obvious way we looked that this was the case is when he went up to work through this pattern of sacrifice and resurrection. When Abraham was told to take him up to Mount Moriah, and we walked through this process which almost identically maps Jesus. There are lots of parts of that story where Isaac had to carry his own wood. He had to willingly be bound, that obviously point to Jesus Christ as well. And then we looked at typology with his marriage to Rebekah, an unnamed servant was sent to fetch a bride from outside the promised land, and there's symptomatic of the church. Rebekah had to leave her family and go and meet Isaac, her bride-to-be, who had left his habitation to meet. And there is typology of the rapture of the church, where the church is removed from earth and Jesus meets us in the air, and we explored all that. So this is all from the past. So that's where we were. And the last two sessions, we've gone further down this patriarchal line, and we're now looking at Jacob and Esau. And if you remember, they were born, they're twins, and even at birth, there was evidence of a coming conflict. Esau is born first, and Jacob comes out grabbing the heel. And I speculate, and this is just a speculation, that he's trying to grab the title of being firstborn. He's trying to get ahead of his slightly older brother. And that's going to play out. Well, it plays out, first of all, when Esau sells his birthright to Jacob. And then Esau decides he wants to claim the blessing. Even though he has technically handed over all the inheritance to his brother, he wants the blessing, and Isaac wants to give him a blessing. And this is where we get into this territory where Jacob is acting deceptively. He's been instructed by his mother, Rebecca. And we have a very tense encounter last time when he pretends he's Esau. And that ends with Jacob obtaining this blessing. Most commentators will have you believe that that was all wrong and it's all out of order. And Jacob is a caricature of the Jews today. You ask people what they think of Jews, they'll go back to Jacob and say he's a deceiver, therefore the Jews are deceivers. That's my big problem with the way we present Jacob. He didn't really do too much wrong. Rebecca is the one who told him what he had to do. And he only took what he was promised, what was his anyway. Isaac was told that the blessing should have gone to Jacob in the first place. He didn't take anything that didn't belong to him. So there's some fairly sinister things going on when you look at Jacob and just accuse him of being a deceiver and someone who steals blessings. It was always supposed to be his. So that's what happened last time. But as a result of this, Jacob is told he has to escape. Esau is incensed. He wants to kill him, and he's looking for an opportunity to do so. Not only that, Isaac, knowing he's done wrong, then instructs Jacob to go and find a bride from outside the land of Canaan. And en route to Haran, where Laban lives. Laban is the brother of Rebecca, who released his sister, although 100 years prior to where we are now. He's going to go back to find Laban to find a bride. And he's going to find more than one bride, as it turns out. And so we're going to get into that tonight. But en route, he has this dream. He falls asleep at Bethel, and he has this dream of a ladder. And you've got angels ascending and descending. And I make the point at the end of the last session that Jesus, amazingly, in John 1:51, refers to himself as the ladder, right at the beginning of the Gospel of John. And that is a tremendously audacious claim to be the ladder, the mediator, the one mediator between God and man. So that's where we were. And he's now arriving in Haran, this is Jacob, to begin a 20-year experience. And it's going to be quite an experience, as we're going to find tonight. He is about 95 years old at this stage. And he's going to be made to work very hard in the coming years. He's going to be treated harshly. He's going to receive underhand treatment from Laban. And again, most people will say this is a punishment for the way he stole the blessing from Esau. I don't really see it that way, but we can all make our minds up as we go along. There's an element of that, I suspect, and there's some irony in what happens, but I don't see this as just a punishment for what Jacob had done before. But you can make your own minds up. So let's turn to Genesis 29, and I'm going to read the first six verses. Then Jacob continued on his journey and came to the land of the eastern peoples. There he saw a well in the field, with three flocks of sheep lying near it, because the flocks were watered from that well. The stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone away from the well's mouth and water the sheep. Then they would return the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob asked the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. He said to them, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yes, we know him," they answered. Then Jacob asked them, "Is he well?" "Yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep." So we're now in what we would call Syria. That's the geography of where he's travelled, hundreds of miles away from where he was before. And the Lord has providently guided him to the exact location of Laban and Rachel, his daughter. He seems a little perplexed over their what they're doing as shepherds. Remember, he's got loads of experience as a shepherd himself. So they're going to start this conversation, and he seems to be trying to understand how they're doing things. And I kind of get the impression as we go along that he thinks they could do things differently. Let's read on for the next few verses from verse 7. "Look," he said, "the sun is still high, and it's not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to pasture." So here he's giving them instructions. "We can't," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well, then we will water the sheep." While they were still talking with him, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. He had told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah. So she ran and told her father. So he's an experienced shepherd, and now he is being critical of the way they're doing things. But I get the impression here that he's seen this beautiful woman coming towards him, and he just wants these shepherds out of the way. You do your thing, you get out of the way, and then I can have some time alone with Rachel. And so a job that apparently needed three or four people a minute ago, he does himself. He picks this big stone up and just launches it where it needs to go, and he's clearly showing off to this lovely lady that's just jumped on the scene. So there's some macho behaviour going on here. We are told three times in this little passage that Laban is his uncle or his mother's brother. And I sense that we're being primed that Laban's going to be heavily involved in any marital arrangements that are going to take place. And although he would get away with a polite kiss as a greeting, remember they're cousins, he seems to go a little bit overboard from what I can see. And I would imagine Rachel would have been very startled by this over-the-top reaction. But it seems there's a hint, at least, of mutual excitement here, given that she runs off to tell Laban of the person she has met. And I would suggest that this is love at first sight. So he's lost his cool a little bit, and he's gone well overboard with his greeting, but she's equally excited. And so Laban is going to find out that this chap, Jacob, has just shown up on the scene. It's around 100 years since Rebekah left Laban to go and marry Isaac. And we're not given any insight that there was communication between the two of them. So this is big news from Laban's perspective as well. But Laban would have been excited to meet his nephew, someone I assume he's not met before. So let's read from verse 13. "As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him. He embraced him and kissed him and brought him into his home, and there Jacob told him all these things. Then Laban said to him, 'You are my own flesh and blood.' After Jacob stayed with him for a whole month, Laban said to him, 'Just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be.' Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, 'I will work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel.' Laban said, 'It's better that I give her to you than some other man. Stay here with me.'" Okay, so there's plenty to catch up on, but the conversation quickly turns quite serious. Now, you imagine that Jacob would have been able and keen to help Uncle Laban with all his work with the sheep. It would provide him a great opportunity to spend some time with Rachel as well, as she's in the same profession. But I can see Laban's mind starting to tick here, and he's sensing opportunity. He will have known very quickly that Jacob would be in line for a sizable inheritance, not to mention a potential spiritual inheritance. Don't think Laban was seeing that, but certainly in terms of possessions and land. And he was thinking there's going to be a deal brewing. But Jacob completely jumps the gun. Rather than be offered wages, Jacob says, I'll work for you for 7 years as long as you give me your daughter. So your younger daughter. Thanks, Scott. So for Laban, this is Christmas come early. Normally, he'd have to pay wages. He's going to get labour free of charge for a period of 7 years. And not only that, he's got a chap in front of him that he would have always dreamed of his daughter marrying. And he's going to get that sorted out all in one go. So his business is going to flourish, and he's found an excellent husband for his younger daughter. So it's a great deal for Laban, and it's also a great deal for Jacob from his perspective, as he's clearly besotted with Rachel. Now, we don't know at this point whether Laban had already planned the deception with Leah that I'm sure you all know about and we're going to read about soon. But I think it would be unusual for his only two daughters to both be unmarried. Now, either he was a very fussy father, or there was some sense of reserving his daughters for some purity. Maybe God just kind of nudged him in some sort of direction to keep them from marrying the local chaps. Not too sure, but it would have been strange that neither of his two daughters were married. And they're physically a little bit different. Now, it's a bit of a strange, this thing about eyes, how is it worded here? I've lost my, does it say weak eyes? So it could be that Rachel had very dark eyes, which would have been a genetic trait, I suppose, of the area, and Leah's weren't as strongly coloured. It could just be that. But we're told that Rachel had a beautiful figure. One commentator suggests that there's an allusion to their characters. This is also describing their characters. So I don't know whether that's true or not. But it is no doubt that Rachel was the more attractive of the two. And as we read on through this story, I think we're going to feel sorry for everyone involved at some point. So this is going to become a very complicated little story. So Rachel's the most attractive of the two, and she's the one that Jacob wants to work for. So from verse 20. So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife. My time is completed and I want to lie with her." So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob, and Jacob lay with her. So Laban gave his servant girl Zilpah to his daughter as her maidservant. I'm afraid it's going to be quite a crude evening. There's going to be a lot of lying with people tonight, so kind of just get yourself prepared for that. But Jacob gladly serves Laban for 7 years, which fly by. But things aren't very simple.
I reckon the first sign of trouble for Jacob would have been when he had to remind Laban that the 7 years were up. Laban hadn't come forward to offer Rachel. He had to kind of knock on the door and say, "Hello, I've done my 7 years.
We had a deal." I'm sure he's starting to smell that something might not be right.
And Laban has devised a very cruel plan. He's now going to solve the problem of his unmarried older daughter. And he's going to try to extract another 7 years of labour from Jacob at the same time. And I reckon he knows Jacob's character. He knows he's an honourable guy. And he's fairly sure that Jacob will stay to honour another 7 years if it comes to it. So he arranges the wedding banquet and Leah is substituted for Rachel. It's quite hard to imagine how you'd pull this off, but I'd imagine that being sisters, although they look different, they would have been similar enough to kind of get away with it in a veiled attire. And by the time the evening came and the marriage was going to be consummated, it would have been dark and it wouldn't have occurred to Jacob that this was going to happen. And so he kind of doesn't find out about it until the next morning. I feel most sorry for Rachel at this point. I doubt she wouldn't obviously have been at this wedding banquet. She would have lived 7 years with the understanding that her husband was being primed for her. And then when it comes to the moment, she's asked to step aside. And Leah, we don't know how willing or unwilling she was, but this is not going to end well. There's no way that this is going to end with anything other than tears. But both of them must have been very unhappy, I would imagine, about this for different reasons. So Rachel has been sidelined and she's basically been whisked off while the older sister is substituted in her place. So verse 25, when morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? Laban replied, it is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Finish this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work. And Jacob did so. He finished the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his servant girl Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maidservant. Jacob lay with Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he worked for Laban another 7 years. Now there is loads in this little section, so I'll try to unpack that. So we don't know whether Leah was a willing participant in this deception. She may have just been commanded to go along with it, but she must have been wondering how her relationship with her sister was ever going to be the same again. Not only that, how is her husband, new husband, going to react in the morning when he discovers that he's married someone he didn't intend to marry? So Jacob discovers what's happened, and understandably, he's very angry and he's very bitter. He's honoured his side of a very clear agreement, and he's been cruelly deceived. Now, at this point, it's possible there would be some irony starting to enter the mind of Jacob due to what happened with the blessing. It's possible. I don't think that would have been an overwhelming emotion, but it's possible. Don't forget, when Jacob took the blessing, it was Rachel who was behind the whole plan. And their motivations were pure throughout that whole episode. Laban's motivations here are not pure at all. So there's lots of big differences between the two things. Now, there's no indication that Jacob was angry with Leah. He now knows that she does love him, I suspect, and he doesn't want to hurt her any more than his initial reaction may have done in the first place. And he approaches Laban and receives a pathetic excuse that this was the custom of the day. Well, if that was the custom of the day, Laban, why didn't you tell me about 7 years ago when you agreed to give me Rachel as as my wife? So this is a terrible excuse. But Jacob's now trapped in many ways. He could demand Rachel as his wife, but I'm not sure how he'd be able to physically enforce this if it came to it. He could refuse to work another 7 years, but then he wouldn't get the woman he had always wanted. And if he suggests he worked less than 7 years, which is a possibility, he's really saying that his new wife is worth less than the wife he's just worked 7 years for. There's really no win for him. There's no way out of this, it's easy. So he does work for the extra 7 years, and in the process, he's forced into bigamy, which is definitely not the best way. But it's already happened within the family. He will no doubt have been aware of his grandfather, Abraham, with both Sarah and Hagar. So maybe he kind of justifies it that way and thinks, well, it's not too unusual. Each daughter is given a handmaid, which was quite common back then. But these handmaids are going to become prominent very shortly, as we're going to see. And I'll flag one other little detail. This word, week. Now, it was normal when you got married back then to have a week-long celebration, a seven-day celebration. And the text implies that Jacob and Rachel consummated their wedding, their relationship, I should say, after the 7 days. If you look down at verse 30 from memory, yeah, Jacob, it says that Jacob lay with Rachel also. And after that, it says, and he worked for Laban another 7 years. In verse 28, it says, he finished the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. They could have consummated their relationship after this 7 day period and waited another 7 years before they officially got married. That's possible. I don't know what the answer to that is. But I think there's a subtle play on words. This word week can mean a period of 7 years. If any of you are familiar with the Daniel's 70th week, Daniel 9, 27. By the way, that is a staggering passage. Jesus spent his whole ministry refusing to be put in the position of a king. And on one specific day, he actually arranges for it to happen. He arranges for everything to happen, and he is welcomed into the city of Jerusalem as the king. He chose it. He orchestrated it all on a very specific day. And if you want to do a study that I think is very exciting, look at Daniel's 70th week and do all the maths behind it. There's loads of material you can use to do that. But those 70 weeks were periods of 7 years. And there could be a play on words in the same way here. Could be. But in any case, we do know for sure that he worked for 7 years, because it says years at the very end in verse 30. And now we get into a fairly lengthy piece of narrative, which details the birth of 11 sons and one daughter at the moment. There's going to be another son born later on. So let's read from verse 35. When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for he said, "It is because the Lord has seen my misery. Surely my husband will love me now." She conceived again, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, "Because the Lord heard that I am not loved, he gave me this one too." So she named him Simeon. Again she conceived, and she gave birth to a son. She said, "Now at last my husband will become attached to me, because I have borne him 3 sons. So his name was Levi. She conceived again, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, "This time I will praise the Lord." So she named him Judah. Then she stopped having children. What we're going to see is a bizarre competition between Rachel and Leah to compete, see how many kids they could have through Jacob. And this is the start of it. So Rachel follows a familiar pattern that we've seen with Sarah and Rebecca, her grandmother and mother-in-law, I should say, that they're barren for a period of time until the Lord gives them children. And the Lord blesses Leah out of concern for her. She's not loved in the way she wants to be loved, so she's blessed with children. And the way she names her sons, Reuben means behold a son. Simeon means hearing, in recognition that God heard her prayers. Levi means attached, which probably conveys the impression that she was now being more attached to her husband, in fact that he was being more devoted to her. And the name Judah means praise, as a token of praise to God. And out of the 4 sons, it's Judah that has a name that that does not reflect her own situation. In other words, there's a spiritual dimension as opposed to something that's just to do with her own circumstances. So maybe it's no wonder that Judah will turn out to be the one in the promise line towards the Messiah. And I'll say at this point that out of the 2 daughters, it seems to me that Leah is the one slightly more attuned spiritually with what's going on from a godly perspective. I don't get that with Rachel at all, or very, very little. Leah seems to me to be the one who's got the spiritual brain switched on. But we'll see as we go through. So Leah is now bearing children, and Rachel is barren. And things are starting to get a little tense in the family. So we'll read from chapter 30, verse 1. So Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children. She became jealous of her sister. So she said to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." Jacob became angry with her and said, "Am I in the place of God who has kept you from having children?" Then she said, "Here is Bilhah, my maidservant. Sleep with her so that she can bear children for me, and that through her I too can build a family." So she gave him her servant Bilhah as a wife. Jacob slept with her, and she became pregnant and bore him a son. Then Rachel said, "God has vindicated me. He has listened to my plea and given me a son." Because of this, she named him Dan. Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Then Rachel said, "I have had a great struggle with my sister, and I have won." So she named him Naphtali. So we'll stop at that point. I can understand her jealousy. It's quite likely now, given that Leah has bore Jacob four sons, that Jacob's attentions now rest more on a day-to-day basis with Leah. And there's probably no doubt that there was an underlying resentment from the fact that she had to wait 7 years due to Leah being substituted in as well. But when Rachel expresses this frustration to Jacob, he gets angry. And it's a bit of an outburst. And there's an implication in his reply that he is suggesting that her barrenness is due to some kind of disobedience. I might be wrong, but it says in verse 2, "Am I in place of God who has kept you from having children?" It's quite probably not a very caring thing to say. So now in desperation, Rachel resorts to the same as what Sarah did with Hagar. Again, coming back to this family history. So rather than wait, she just takes matters into her own hands, which again is never the best thing to do. She's not being patient. And as it was with Sarah, this was an acceptable practice of the day and one of the possible functions of having a handmaid. But I would argue that this demonstrated a lack of trusting in God's promises. Anyhow, through this method, she gets two children. She has one called Dan, which is a fantastic name, I might add. And it means justice, in recognition, no doubt, that she feels justice has been done for her. And the other one, Naphtali, means wrestlings, which is a description of what's going on between her and her sister. But as we are now going to discover, Leah was in no mood to accept defeat at this point. So let's read on from verse 9. "When Leah saw that she had stopped having children, she took her maidservant Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, 'What good fortune!' So she named him Gad. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, 'How happy I am! The women will call me happy.' So she named him Asher." So Leah had stopped bearing children and now decides to adopt the same course of action as her sister. So her handmaid has two sons, as we hear, they're called Gad and Asher. And it's difficult to tell what Jacob thinks about all this. It sounds to me as though his response is one of passive compliance. I'm not sure how much he enjoyed it, this being passed around. But it seems to me that whatever bed he's told to go to, he just does it. Very hard for us to understand this. How two wives could so readily share their husbands with their handmaids. But I suppose it demonstrates the security and status that came with having children in the day, that would trump any feelings of jealousy or being more possessive over your husband. So at this point, Jacob has eight sons. He's had four through Leah, two through Rachel's handmaid, and two from Leah's handmaid. And then we read of a very strange encounter. This is an odd encounter. Let's have a look. Verse 14. "So during the wheat harvest, Reuben..." By the way, Reuben, I would guess, was about 8 to 10 years old, I suspect. So he's just wandering around in the fields. So I suspect that's how old he is. "So during the wheat harvest, Reuben went out into the fields and found some mandrake plants, which he brought to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, Please give me some of your son's mandrakes. Remember, Rachel has not given birth herself yet. But she said to her, wasn't it enough that you took away my husband? Will you take my son's mandrakes too? Very well, Rachel said. He can sleep with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes. So when Jacob came in from the fields that evening, Leah went out to meet him. You must sleep with me, she said. I have hired you with my son's mandrakes. So he slept with her that night. So what is a mandrake? Well, it's a small berry-like fruit. And it had a reputation of being an inducer of fertility back then. And I suspect there's an element of superstition with it as well. And Rachel suspects that this is maybe where Leah's getting her tactical advantage from. And she wants some of this for herself. So Reuben comes in with all his fruits in her hand. He's obviously just picking away at these little berry trees. And she wants some of these mandrakes. She must have been controlling the family home, Rachel. I don't know how it all worked out with who was living where, but access to Jacob was being controlled by Rachel. And she uses this as leverage in her negotiation. So they make this deal. Leah, just to make sure nothing can go wrong, she runs out into the field before Jacob can get back, explains the situation. And Jacob, as always, just because he wants to avoid anything going wrong and just wants to keep the peace, he just passively goes along with everything and is led away. So verse 17. So God listened to Leah, and she became pregnant and bore Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, God has rewarded me for giving my maidservant to my husband. So she named him Issachar. Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. Then Leah said, God has presented me with a precious gift. This time my husband will treat me with honour because I have borne him six sons. So she named him Zebulun. Sometime later she gave birth to a daughter and named her Dinah. So we have another flurry of childbearing activity from Leah. This is now six children. And we've got Issachar and Zebulun. The daughter Dinah her name means judgment. And this is the first mention of a daughter. And statistically, it's quite unlikely you'd have, where are we now? I think 10 sons before you have your first daughter. And we will find out that they do go on to have daughters later on. But I'm pretty sure, given the narrative, if there had been daughters born up to this point, we would have heard about it before now. Now, I mentioned Dinah, and because next session, she's going to be the subject of a nasty attack that leads to a very bitter battle between the sons of Jacob and a local tribe. So she's going to be a big player in next week's Bible study. Okay, let's move on. Verse 22. Then God remembered Rachel and listened to her and opened her womb. Remember, she's the only one that hasn't had children out of his quartet. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son and said, God has taken away my disgrace. She named him Joseph and said, may the Lord add to me another son. So after many years, God finally answers Rachel's prayers for a child, and she gives birth to Joseph, whose name means may he add, obviously in the hope that she would have more children, I suspect. At this point, Jacob has 11 sons, and things are now going to go a little quiet on the childbearing front until Rachel will give birth to Benjamin next week, in terms of where we are Bible study. I think it's next week. and that's a sad story, because in giving birth to Benjamin, she'll die. She'll pass on during the process. She'll die in childbirth. So that'll be the end of Rachel. But so at the moment we've got 11, and we will have 12. And I mention that now because once we've got our 12, we've got the 12 tribes of Israel. And these 12 tribes of Israel are listed in various parts of Scripture. But oftentimes there's a subtle difference in the naming of these tribes. Joseph will have two children, Ephraim and Manasseh. And it's very odd. It's quite an interesting study, if you want to get into it, how various individuals are slotted in and out of this list of 12 tribes. Sometimes Levi is taken out because he's considered he's the priestly tribe. And so sometimes he's omitted and it's Joseph's two sons rather than Joseph. In Revelation 7, we have a list of 12 tribes. And on that occasion, Dan is not included. And I did write this down. There's no Dan and there's no Ephraim. But there is Joseph and Levi. So you can delve into this in your own time. It is probably quite an interesting study if you want to get behind it. But I'll just make that point now. We've really got 13 sons who are slotted in and out in the different renderings of these 12 tribes. So at this point, coming back to our narrative, Jacob has far outworked his contract with Laban. He's worked 14 years. He's had 12 children. And he's getting restless and he wants to return home. Remember, the only reason he came to Haran was to escape Esau and to obtain a wife. He's now been there for longer than he planned and he wants to get back. So let's read from verse 25. So after Rachel gave birth to Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, "Send me on my way so that I can go back to my own homeland. Give me my wives and children for whom I have served you, and I will be on my way. You know how much work I have done for you." But Laban said to him, "If I have found favour in your eyes, please stay. I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you." He added, "Name your wages and I will pay them." So Laban's getting a bit desperate now. You can see he recognises he's been very great fortune through having Jacob with him. And he basically says to Jacob, "You name your price and you can have it." The Hebrew word for divination is nachash. And it's the same root the word serpent comes from. And this indicates he took part in enchantments or of divination, as it says here. But through this, Laban had become aware that the God that Jacob worshipped was the true God. He was dealing with the true God here. So there was some kind of occult practice taking place with Laban. And he knew that Jacob was under the special care of the true God. But as we have already partly discovered with Laban, greed is going to get the better of him. And things are now going to get a little very underhand. Remember, Laban has no leverage. There's nothing that Laban can offer Jacob. He's got two daughters. He knows Laban has been blessed in terms of possessions hugely because of him. Laban can offer nothing. So he's getting desperate. So we're going to have... But Jacob wants to be seen to be generous. So he offers a deal. Listen to this. Verse 29. This is quite hard to follow. I'll try and explain this clearly. So Laban has said, "Name your wages and I'll pay them." Jacob said to him, "You know how I've worked for you and how your livestock has fared under my care. The little you had before I came has increased greatly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I have been. But now, when may I do something for my own household?" "What shall I give you?" he asked. "Don't give me anything," Jacob replied. But if you will do this one thing for me, I will go on tending your flocks and watching over them. Let me go through all your flocks today and remove from them every speckled or spotted sheep, every dark-coloured lamb, and every spotted or speckled goat. They will be my wages. And my honesty will testify for me in the future. Whenever you check on the wages you have paid me, any goat in my possession that is not speckled or spotted, or any lamb that is not dark-coloured, will be considered stolen." "Agreed," said Laban. "Let it be as you have said." So basically, in terms of managing livestock, the least desirable of the animals, Jacob's saying, "I'll take those, and you can keep all the others." So naturally, Laban agrees. And there's going to be a breeding program that we're going to read about now that takes place. Remember, Jacob is an expert with livestock. And Jacob is basically going to leave this in God's hands. He is going to set the circumstances where Jacob cannot complain that he's been treated unfairly, where from a human perspective he's got no chance of having any reward or abundance through this breeding program. And he's saying to the Lord, I'll leave it over to you. He's going to use a little bit of expertise, as we'll see, but that's what's going on. So naturally, Laban is delighted. It's an incredibly generous offer from a human perspective, and Laban should do very well out of this. But Jacob is trusting that God will provide him for what he needs. But now, Laban, being the untrustworthy sort of chap he is, he thinks there's a catch, and he now takes very naughty action. Let's listen to verse 35 and 36. So Laban has just agreed to this deal. That same day, he, that's Laban, removed all the male goats that were streaked or spotted, and all the speckled or spotted female goats, all that had white on them, and all the dark-coloured lambs. And he placed them in the care of his sons. And he put a three-day journey between himself and Jacob, while Jacob continued to tend the rest of Laban's flocks. Now, I'm not a great in terms of genetic expertise, but I'll try and explain what I think is going on here. So you've got a flock of livestock. I won't get into all the speckled and the spotted and all that. It's going to drive me nuts. But you've got a flock of livestock. The ones that were kind of mixed up in terms of being clearly one colour or the other were not considered as valuable. And Jacob is saying, I'll take those. And they both agree to do some kind of breeding programme. Over the coming, it'll turn out to be 6 years, and that'll be Jacob's inheritance. All the purely coloured ones, they're for Laban. They agree to that. But now when Jacob turns his back, Laban takes away everything except the ones that Jacob expects to breed from. So his stock disappears. And he puts a three-day journey in between them both so there can be no mixing whatsoever. So this is now Laban being very naughty indeed. He's basically giving, from a human perspective, Jacob no chance whatsoever. There is no genetic material with what he's got to work with that's going to give him what should be his own inheritance. So he has now manipulated circumstances to leave Jacob with nothing. So that's kind of what's going on with all these weird descriptions. That's how I see it. And this three-day journey is leaving no chance whatsoever of any mixing. So from a human point of view, Laban can only win. Jacob's got absolutely no chance whatsoever. I'll describe it like this, and I'm on dodgy ground. I'll just describe it like this. If you were to do the same with human, let's use dogs. If you were to do it with dogs, you could have very long-haired dogs due to certain breeds and very short-haired dogs. And you'd have ones with medium long-haired dogs, some not long, not short. And Jacob's taking over one with medium long hair. That's the deal. Basically, Laban's removed all the genetic material to take that middle ground. So he's left with absolutely nothing. So it's just a little bit more complex the way it's described in here. So he should not be doing well with this situation. So this is now a very practical insight into breeding back then. So verse 37. Jacob, however, took a fresh cut branches from poplar, almond and plane trees and made white stripes on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood of the branches. Then he placed the peeled branches in all the watering troughs so that they would be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. When the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they mated in front of the branches and they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. Jacob set apart the young of a flock by themselves, but made the rest face the streaked and dark-coloured animals that belonged to Laban. Then he made separate flocks for himself and did not put them with Laban's animals. Whenever the stronger females were in heat, Jacob would place the branches in the troughs in front of the animals so that they would mate near the branches. But if the animals were weak, he would not place them there. So the weak animals went to Laban and the strong ones to Jacob. In this way, the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to his own large flocks and maidservants and men servants and camels and donkeys. So God has blessed him. He's used his brain. So he understands breeding. He understands genetics. So despite the fact odds are completely stacked against him, he's worked with what he's got to try and make the situation as good as it can be. But despite that, God has still blessed him hugely. And I love this detail at the end. He's gone from having flocks, and it's been so abundant, he now needs servants to manage them. He's got maidservants, men servants, camels and donkeys. So he's just blossomed. So this is a combination of being richly blessed by God, despite all the odds being against him, and him using his own expertise in the given situation. I think there's lots of lessons for us in that process as well. This is, I've read commentators who accuse him just of using an unfair advantage with all these, but this isn't about an unfair advantage. He's been set up to lose. God has blessed him, and he's just used what he knows to do the best he possibly can with the little he had to work with. We should do the same. So, okay, we're going to keep moving because we've got a whole chapter to get through before the end. So that's where we are. So now he's got all these flocks. What Laban was expecting to finish him, he has now got loads. So this is going to cause problems for Laban. Jacob heard that Laban's sons were saying, "Jacob has taken everything our father owned and has gained all this wealth from what belonged to our father." And Jacob noticed that Laban's attitude towards him was not what it had been. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." This is where the Lord steps in. The Lord says, "Go back." So all of a sudden, a deal that Laban couldn't see how he could possibly lose was turning into a situation where everything he had was now slipping away. Everything was turning sour, and Jacob could sense tension. And I don't think he knew what to do. And it's at this point that the Lord steps in and says, "This situation is getting serious now. It's potentially dangerous. Maybe there was a threat of Laban attacking in some way. And he needs to leave, and he needs to leave quickly. But he needs to get his wives and his family on board." So that's going to be the next job for him. So verse 4. So Jacob sent word to Rachel and Leah to come out to the fields where the flocks were, away from Laban, obviously. He said to them, "I see that your father's attitude towards me is not what it was before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have worked for your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. If he said the speckled ones will be your wages, then all the flocks gave birth to the speckled young. And if he said the streaked ones will be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked young. So God has taken away your father's livestock and he has given them to me." In the breeding season, I once had a dream in which I looked up and saw the male goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled or spotted. The angel of the Lord said to me in the dream, "Jacob." I answered, "Here I am." And he said, "Look up and see that all the male goats mating with the flock are streaked, speckled or spotted. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land at once and go back to your native land." So Jacob is worried it's not going to be easy to get Rachel and Leah on board. So he just explains the situation and they completely buy in. He's now been 20 years with Laban, 14, two lots of 7 years working, and 6 years, I'm not sure if you've come across it yet, but we'll be told in a moment, and 6 years with this little breeding program. But his wives knew their future was with him. They saw through the character of their own father. They knew that Jacob was honourable, and I suspect they just knew they had a better future with Jacob. Not to mention the fact that I'm sure Jacob had told them about the true God and the spiritual dimension and the promises that were going to be held down through him as well. So the godly dimension in all this. I need to keep moving because we've got a lot to do in the next 5 minutes. So verse 14. Then Rachel and Leah replied, Do we still have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate? Does he not regard us as foreigners? Not only has he sold us, but he has used us. Sorry, he has used up what was paid for us. Surely all the wealth that God took away from our father belongs to you and our children. So do whatever God has told you. So there is underlying resentment from Rachel and Leah towards their father that is now starting to be displayed as well. Verse 17. Then Jacob put his children and his wives on camels. He drove all his livestock ahead of him, along with the goods he had accumulated in Padan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. When Jacob had gone to shear his sheep, Rachel stole his father's household gods. Moreover, Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him he was running away. So he fled with all he had, and crossing the river, he headed for the hill country of Gilead. The big picture here is in verse 18, where we're told Jacob is going to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. This is where he's getting back onto the territory of the promised land. That's the big picture. This is where his birthright is. This is where we receive a blessing. Remember, he is God's man in terms of the redemptive plan. A plan of redemption. So he is now becoming aware that he's got a job to do and he needs to leave. But Rachel has stolen these gods. It would be these little figurines that were no doubt belong to Laban. So we'll come back to that in just a minute. Verse 22. On the third day, Laban was told that Jacob had fled. Taking his relatives with him, he pursued Jacob for 7 days and caught up with him in the hill country of Gilead. Then God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream at night and said to him, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, evil, good or bad." But now, it's quite incredible. We're talking about a 300-mile distance between Haran and Gilead. So Jacob and family have taken probably 10 or 11 days to travel it. They're escaping, so they're not hanging around. But when Laban discovers, he takes his family, he covers the distance in 7 days. This is a tense affair. And God gets involved here. Laban is told, you're not to speak to Jacob, good or bad. In other words, you're not allowed to convince him to come back with you. And you're certainly not allowed to reproach him for leaving. Verse 25. Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country of Gilead when Laban overtook him, and Laban and his relatives camped there too. Then Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done? You deceived me and you carried off my daughters like captives in war. Why did you run off secretly and deceive me? Why didn't you tell me that I could send, so that I could send you away with joy and singing to the music of tambourines and harps? You didn't even let me kiss my grandchildren and my daughters goodbye. You have done a foolish thing. I have the power to harm you, but last night the God of your father said to me, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.' Now you have gone off because you long to return to your father's house, but why did you steal my gods?" So this is pitiful pretense from Laban. He's now feigning affection for his family, but Jacob doesn't see through it at all. In fact, I'm not going to go through all my notes here, but Jacob is not going to offer much in terms of a rebuttal. He just basically says to Laban, "Whatever you say, don't worry, we're going to go." But this issue with this little god that Rachel's picked up is going to become a pressing thing. Let's read on from verse 31. So Jacob says to Laban, "I was afraid because I thought you would take your daughters away from me by force. But if you find anyone who has your gods, he shall not live. In the presence of our relatives, see for yourself whether there is anything of yours here with me. And if so, take it." Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen the gods. So Jacob dismisses the notion of this theft of these gods, and he basically says to Laban, "If you can find it, you can punish whoever's stolen it, however you like." Verse 33. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maidservants, but he found nothing. After he came out of Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them inside the camel saddle and was sitting on them. I don't think the saddle was actually on the camel at this time, just to make that clear. Laban searched through everything in the tent, but found nothing. Rachel said to her father, "Don't be angry, my lord. I cannot stand up in your presence. I'm having my period." So he searched but could not find for household gods. So Rachel is now acutely aware of how foolish she has been. We assume she is making this up. Can't say for 100% sure, but I assume she's making it up. And given that Jacob is genuinely innocent, he allows this deception to... Basically, they get away with it. And Laban isn't going to find anything. So Jacob now is going to get very angry at the way Laban has accused him and his family of stealing. Verse 36. So Jacob was angry and took Laban to task. "What is my crime?" he asked Laban. "What sin have I committed that you hunt me down? Now that you have searched through all my goods, what have you found that belongs to your household? Put it here in front of your relatives and mine and let them judge between the two of us. I have been with you for 20 years now. Your sheep and goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten rams from your flocks. I did not bring your animals torn by wild beasts. I bore the loss myself. And you demanded payment from me for whatever was stolen by day or night. This was my situation. The heat consumed me in the daytime and the cold at night, and sleep fled from my eyes. It was like this for 20 years I was in your household. I worked for you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been with me, you would have surely sent me away empty-handed. But God has seen my hardship and the toil of my hands, and last night he rebuked you." So Jacob's basically leaving it totally on the line here. He's just being totally honest. Verse 43, I'll read to the end. Laban answered Jacob, "The women are my daughters, the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks. All you see is mine. Yet what can I do today about these daughters of mine or about the children they have borne? Come now, let's make a covenant, you and I, and let it serve as a witness between us." So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. He said to his relatives, "Gather some stones." So they took stones and piled them up in a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Jacob called it Jager Sahadutha, and Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, "The heap is a witness between you and me today. That is why it's called Galeed." It was also called Mizpah, because he said, "May the Lord keep watch between you and me when we are away from each other. If you ill-treat my daughters, or if you take any wives beside my daughters, even though no one is with us, remember that God is a witness between you and me." Laban also said to Jacob, "Here is the heap, and here is the pillar I have set up between you and me. The heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness, but I will not go past this heap to your side to harm you, and you will not go past this heap and the pillar to my side to harm me. May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor," interesting, "and the God of their father judge between us." So Jacob took an oath in the name of the fear of the father Isaac. He offered a sacrifice there in the hill country and invited his relatives to a meal. After they had eaten, they spent the night there. Early in the morning, Laban kissed his grandchildren and his daughters and blessed them. Then he left and returned home. So in the way it ends seems to end okay. Laban tries to control the terms of the agreements, making spurious assumptions against Jacob, as he has done the whole time. He tries to invoke the name of his God in verse 53, but Isaac basically seems to be saying, "Keep talking, don't worry, we're going to make this deal and go our own way." Okay, big picture before I finish. Jacob is now free of one crisis. He has escaped from Laban. He's got a massive family. He's escaped from Laban, but he's walking straight into another crisis. He's about to be reunited with Esau, and the last he knew of Esau, Esau wanted to kill him. So he's in between the two. And what's going to happen first is we're going to have a bizarre encounter where Jacob wrestles with an angel. So that's going to be next time. So I'll stop straight away because I've gone over by 5 minutes. So sorry about that. Let me pray and we'll... A couple of questions. Holy Father, I thank you and praise you for your word. There is so much that we don't understand. There's so much that comes from a culture we can't relate to. But I thank you for the way you work. You work for the good of all of us in this line towards our Lord and Saviour, Jesus Christ.
Holy Father, I pray as we leave, you would touch each of us with an insight, and that we glean something we didn't know of you when we came in this evening. In your mercy, I pray your word would richly dwell within us as we go to our homes. In Jesus' precious name, amen.